Lecture 2. Big Government is Conceived. Income Tax, the Federal Reserve, World War I.
You can think of the first decade of the 20th century as being the last of red-blooded, full-throated, get out of my way or I'll run you down, who is the government anyway, American capitalism. An evolution begins in the second decade of the century. The government begins to do more things like setting up an income tax, setting up a Federal Reserve system, setting up antitrust laws that actually have some hope of working. And of course, in the second half of this decade, there's the overwhelming change in between the government and the economy, which is brought about by the effects of World War I. Let's sort of work through the decade and think about how this changing situation and relationship of government to the economy took place. One institution which people always want to know about is the income tax, how it got started, what its rationale was, why it has the shape that it has. There had been a brief income tax that passed during the Civil War years as a way of raising money during the war, but it was really just a wartime measure that was quickly repealed after the war. In 1894, Congress passed another income tax, but that was eventually thrown out by the Supreme Court. And going back and reading the decision, it really seems to be it was one of those great politicized decisions where the older justices basically said, we think an income tax is socialism, is communism, is seizure of property. We don't like income taxes at all. And they felt so strongly about it that they just went ahead and sort of voted against it. The counterargument before the Supreme Court was, there's nothing in the Constitution that forbids an income tax, and after all, the legislature voted for one, and we do live in a majority rule country, so we should probably do what the majority votes for on this, but that didn't carry a whole lot of weight with the justices of that time. What was the pro and con argument in a policy sense about the income tax over those years? There was a sense that the great technological developments of the time, all the changes in globalization, the huge corporations, they were all leading to a greater amount of income inequality. They were leading to the rich being richer and the poor being poorer in the way we say it toward the end of the century. In particular, most of government revenue at the time is coming from tariffs. Remember, these are taxes on imports. Through the late 19th and early 20th century, the typical progressive liberal argument was that this was not a good way for the government to raise money. Because after all, if you tax imports, you're taxing things that people buy. And those taxes on imports, those taxes on things people buy, are going to have a heavier burden on poor people who have to spend all of their income on various goods that they need to live than they're going to have on rich people. So the notion was, let's switch over a little bit. Instead of having government raise money by tariffs, let's raise it by an income tax on the very rich. And really, we mean the very, very rich. Frankly, it would be nice to see some of this logic today. By the end of the century, we now tend to see progressive and liberal forces more commonly arguing that we should shut out imports in order to protect middle-class jobs. But of course, the same logic holds true as did then. Whenever you shut out imports, whenever you impose tariffs, whenever you impose quotas, you're restricting the amount of competition. You're keeping the price higher than it would otherwise be. And it's going to be true in that situation that poor people are affected more by that. And for things like sugar and clothing and all those sorts of things, they're going to have to pay higher prices as a result of protecting those industries. So the notion was we should have an income tax that will help go after the growing amount of inequality, and it will perhaps help to replace these taxes which are burdening the poor more heavily. Now, this was really conceived as something which was really just going to go after the very, very highest earners. When started in 1913, the income tax was a rate of 1% on income above $20,000 and 7% on taxable incomes above $500,000. Now, if you multiply that up into today's dollars, and remember we'd have to be multiplying by a factor of like 20 here, what you would sort of be saying is that the 1% tax rate kicked in on those who in modern terms might be people with sort of low six-figure incomes, and the upper rate, the 7% rate, would really have only kicked in on the super, super, super rich. I mean, you know, on Bill Gates, on Ross Perot, on Michael Jordan and people like that. So the income tax, when first instituted, only touches about 2% of the population, and it's really only intended to touch those upper 2%. Now, of course, there are probably some people who saw the income tax as sort of the beginning of something where over time they would build up and build up and take more and more from the rich and give to the poor. I'm sure there were socialists who supported it in that way. But as far as I can tell, not very many people saw the income tax as a way of funding big government, because big government, in some sense, just wasn't in the public mind. It wasn't in the public agenda. And they really were talking more about just taking some away from the very, very rich and replacing these taxes that they didn't like quite as much. It is, of course, ironic that only a few years later, during World War I, the income tax will shift dramatically in such a way that it will become an enormous revenue raiser for government. But that's getting ahead of our story. Let me first talk about the second major institution, which is built at about this time, the Federal Reserve System. Now remember, the Federal Reserve System is growing out of the financial panic of '07. There was a feeling that the banking system was just too fragile, that you could get situations where you could have a run on a bank or a fragile bank, the banks would shut down, and as a result, when the banks were shut, that would cripple the local economy. So there was some sense that we needed to do something to make the banking system more stable than it was. Well, what did the Federal Reserve System at this time actually do? Well, at the most basic, simple level, it set up a way of thinking about all the banks as part of an interconnected system. It set up a system of 12 district banks, Federal Reserve districts, throughout the country. Because the economy at the time is centered largely in the East, the Federal Reserve districts are also centered largely in the East. So the cities that they are in are Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and Richmond in the East. And then in the Midwest, Cleveland, Chicago, Minneapolis, St. Louis, Kansas City. A couple of them were in the South, Dallas and Atlanta, and one in the far West, out in San Francisco. Now, if you wonder why the 12 Federal Reserve districts are where they are, that's because they decided in 1913 to put them there. Occasionally, people have argued since then that given the growth in the Western and the Southern economy, it might make sense to relocate some of these Federal Reserve districts and have them more evenly representing the distribution of the modern economy. But apparently, it's just far too much political trouble to try and do that, and I'm not sure that there's a big benefit to doing it anyway. Why did they have 12 districts? Well, the real reason was there was a fear at the time that if you only had one district, it would be like a giant trust or a giant monopoly that controlled all the money of the country. And so by dividing up into 12 districts, the notion was that you wouldn't have a money trust. Now, frankly, this concern seems a little silly from the standpoint of the time. If you're going to set up one national system with 12 branch offices, you're effectively saying that some kind of national control is going to happen. And it's not clear that the 12 different districts avoid that from happening in any useful way. But still, maybe different districts could disagree. It's important to have some division in your power structure so you don't just have one dictatorial voice. At any event, they decided to have 12 districts. So, one thing they're going to do is set up this system of these 12 different districts, and they're going to try and set up the system so it's coordinated and it can avoid disasters in banking. All national banks being banks that have a charter from the national government, were required to become members of the Federal Reserve System. And state banks could become members if they met certain conditions about stability and having enough money and so on. The regional federal banks, the 12 regional banks, are then owned by their member banks, the banks that are headquartered in their district. And those banks are required to buy stock in the Federal Reserve System. So they own the Federal Reserve in the sense that the banks themselves own stock in the system. Each of the regional banks chooses a governor who's elected by the member banks, and that governor will sort of speak up for that region's banks as a group. The local banks are becoming, as you can imagine, a little bit less important here, but they're tied into the system because the Federal Reserve is going to help shift money back and forth between banks, help clear checks, help move payments back and forth between the banks, and all those kinds of things. We kind of take some of those things for granted, but they're really not small things at all. The Federal Reserve System is going to distribute currency. If you look at a bill in your pocket, you know, some sort of a currency bill, you'll see that there's a little circle on the left which tells you which Federal Reserve Bank distributed that bill. And the Federal Reserve was trying to encourage banks to avoid a system where there would be a bank run and they would lose their currency or lose their money. Now, I've said bank run a couple of times. It's maybe important to say just what a bank run is. A bank run is a system where people are worried that the bank might be going to go broke. It might have made bad loans, it might have speculated on the stock market, all those kinds of things. So, in a time when your deposits are not insured, if you think your bank might be about to go broke, you rush down to the bank. You run to the bank in order to take out your money. But when you start taking money out of a bank, other people think, oh my, look, you know, people have run to the bank and they also rush down to the bank. And so once a bank run starts, once a crisis of confidence happened in a bank, it could sort of build in kind of like a snowball or an avalanche. And as a result, once all the money had been pulled out of the bank, then the bank really was bankrupt. And it didn't matter whether originally their bank really did have a problem or whether it was only a rumor. And the notion was, at that time, and this is probably true, that a lot of the time there were just rumors about banks, or there were short-term problems the bank could have overcome in a month or two. But once there was that lack of confidence and the bank run had started, then the banks had to close their doors because they just, you know, they didn't have the money to give out, and they couldn't liquidate all their assets instantaneously in order to give everyone their money back. Now, the Federal Reserve sort of has this system. There's this network of banks. There's this notion of distributing the banks, having them work together, trying to stop bank runs. But it still really has some severe problems. It doesn't really have the power to regulate the banking system in a firm way. They can sort of tell people what to do, and there's this interlocking system, but it's not clear how those regulations will work. Moreover, remember the nation is still on a gold standard, and so the amount of gold is still largely determining the money supply in the economy. And the Federal Reserve, if the money supply is being determined largely by gold, then the Federal Reserve, it's not clear what they're supposed to be doing. Are they supposed to be regulating the money supply? Are they supposed to be regulating the banks? And there's this clear sense that somehow the banking system wasn't working. It was breaking down. These runs were irrational. But it wasn't yet clear what kind of power the Federal Reserve really should have in order to change those conditions. And so the Federal Reserve exists. It's kind of sort of trying to get established and figure out what's going on. But World War I is about to arrive. And that's going to mean that the Federal Reserve system becomes unimportant in the national eye for a few years while we worry about the World War. The third big institutional change from the first half of this decade involves shifts in antitrust law. You'll remember that in the previous decades, there hadn't really been a whole lot in the way of antitrust enforcement. There had been some, but not a whole lot. There are various laws passed, however, and there was a general shift through that decade as people talked about Standard Oil and the antitrust movement toward believing that competition really did have some value. So by about 1911, the spirit of the Supreme Court, which you remember used to take the antitrust laws and use them to beat up on unions, by about 1911, the spirit of the Supreme Court is shifting in various ways. And there are actually two major cases where they decide to break up large companies. And those two cases, one involves Rockefeller's Standard Oil. I'm afraid Standard Oil kind of became a target after Tarbell's book. And also the other big case involved American Tobacco, which was a big monopoly that controlled most of the tobacco production at the time. Both of these controlled perhaps 90% of their markets in the country. Both firms had nasty, nasty reputations for playing competitive hardball, for going in places, undercutting and driving people out of business any way they could, buying them out, and then jacking up the price to earn higher profits. This is what Tarbell was referring to as predatory competition. You lose some money up front because, after all, you have to cut prices to drive them out of business. But once they're gone, you make it all up in higher monopoly profits after that time, and you scare people from ever trying to undercut you on price. Now, there's a deeper lesson here that's worth emphasizing. Many businesses hate a free competitive market. There's often a feeling among common discourse, popular discourse, that business people are in favor of a free enterprise system and a competitive market. I believe nothing could be further from the truth. If you're running a business, the last thing you want is tough competitors undercutting you, driving you out of business, forcing you to take losses. What you really want if you're a business person is a well-organized system where nobody's being too viciously competitive, no one's trying to undercut you too much, and everyone's agreeing to keep prices relatively high. This whole rhetoric about, you hear from business people about cutthroat competition, is rhetoric which leads to people saying, well, it's too cutthroat for me. But from the standpoint of consumers and from the standpoint of the economy having incentives for people to work harder and become more efficient, competition is a tremendously important thing. Now, the Supreme Court did indeed rule these two firms were guilty. It broke them up into several separate little firms. So, for example, Standard Oil was broken up into geographically separate firms. And those separate firms first marketed in different geographic areas and then eventually started competing with each other more broadly across the country. However, the Supreme Court's decisions in these cases emphasized that what was unfair was not that they had 90% of the market. What was unfair was the way in which they had gotten that 90% of the market, these predatory practices of undercutting other folks. And so, in fact, soon after this, in other decisions which involved Eastman Kodak, International Harvester, U.S. Steel, toward the end of this decade, those companies were found not guilty of being monopolists, not guilty of monopolizing their market, even though they had very large market shares, because they were found they had accomplished those market shares not by the dirty tactics that Standard Oil and American Tobacco had used, but just by cleanly producing more efficiently than other folks. Now, that line is, of course, kind of a thin one, but you can see antitrust law is sort of being defined as unfair practices are a bad thing, but if you just get really big and powerful because you did it in a fair way, that's going to be regarded as acceptable. In 1914, following up on these Supreme Court cases, Congress passed the Clayton Antitrust Act and the Federal Trade Commission Act. And many people have heard of the Federal Trade Commission nowadays. It's the agency which we have in the federal government to help oversee mergers and various kinds of antitrust law. The notion here was to make it the Sherman Antitrust Act enforceable, to make clear what it meant, to make clear that certain business practices were illegal and there would be a federal agency to enforce them. And the feeling was it had to be a federal agency, because if it wasn't a federal agency, then companies would seek out whichever states had the most lenient laws. In fact, the reason so many states were incorporated in places like Delaware goes back to the days of around this time when states were seeking out companies were seeking out whichever state had the nicest legal environment and then locating in that kind of a state. But, you know, the Federal Trade Commission Act is still pretty darn vague. The first 10 words say, "Unfair methods of competition in commerce are hereby declared unlawful." Well, it's good to know that unfair methods are unlawful, but what precisely are those unfair methods? And how do you differentiate? Is cutting the price to give a better product unfair? Well, it's not altogether clear. The Federal Trade Commission was sort of given the task of trying to figure out what was going to, in practice, be considered unfair and what wasn't. But again, we're right on the edge of World War I, and that sort of set of decisions is going to have to wait. What happens during to the U.S. economy during World War I? Remember, the war itself starts in about 1914 over various European political squabbles, which frankly look increasingly unimportant with the passage of time. Our concern, however, is how the war affects the U.S. economy. The U.S. doesn't really start preparing to enter the war until about 1916, and we don't actually enter until April of 1917. So there are several years where the war is going on, and at least from the government point of view, we haven't done very much to think about entering the war. For the record, at this time during 1914-1915, we're neutral. We're willing to sell both to Germany and to the Allied powers like Britain. However, we tend to be selling a little bit more to the Allied powers like Britain, and Germany regards us as hostile. They're sending out submarines to sink our ships. So how does this affect the economy in a narrow way? The first major change is that it changes the United States from an international debtor to an international creditor. A lot of the growth of the U.S. economy, the building of the railroads and those kinds of things, happened on borrowed money. And it was money borrowed from European investors, by and large. So the United States economy as a whole owed more to these foreign investors. We were debtors. We owed money to investors in the rest of the world. But now, the first couple of years of the war, the U.S. is exporting all kinds of stuff overseas. We're exporting not only weapons and food, various sorts of items that can be used by the folks fighting the war. We start running trade surpluses. And they aren't buying, they're buying a lot from us, but we're not importing much from them. Because after all, you know, when you're fighting a war, you're not making a lot of things that you're exporting to other countries. Now, the U.S. economy is earning money from all of these exports. And as we keep earning all this money, we eventually pay off all the debts we had accumulated during the 19th century. Moreover, we begin to lend money abroad, to Britain in particular, but to some other countries as well, so that they can buy our materials and continue to fight the war. So by the end of the war, the U.S. has been converted from a nation which owed money to the rest of the world to a nation which was lending money to the rest of the world. And we're going to stay a creditor nation to the rest of the world until the 1980s, when various events that we'll get to then switch us back into being a debtor nation. A second big change in the war is that government discovers it has an enormous new ability to raise revenue. Before about 1915, as we mentioned before, federal government spending is less than 2% of the economy, less than 2% of GDP per year. In 1918, federal spending is 16% of the economy. So it goes up by a factor of almost 8. In 1919, it's 22% of the economy, which is approximately the same size as the government to the economy is in the 1990s. Of course, during the 1920s, after the war, the government shrinks back again down to about 7% of the economy, but it's still considerably larger, maybe two or three times larger than it was before World War I took place. Why is there this big expansion in the government share of the economy? Well, a lot of it, of course, is just paying soldiers. The armed forces of this country were about 160,000 people before World War I. At the peak of the World War I, we had about 3 million soldiers under arms. So that's a multiple by a factor of like 18 or something like that. How do we pay for these folks? Well, in 1913, remember, the top rate on new individual income tax was about 7% on incomes above $500,000. By 1918, the top rate was 77% on incomes above $1 million, and it was 6% on incomes above $4,000. The floor came down, the rates went up in an awfully big hurry. By 1919, the tax that was just supposed to hit millionaires is now reaching 30% of the population. And even though the rates do come back down again to some extent in the 1920s, World War I is in some sense responsible for really taking the income tax and turning it from a true millionaire's tax, or almost millionaire's tax, into something which really hits the broad upper class, more broadly defined. However, these taxes weren't enough in and of themselves in order to pay for World War I. The federal government also had to borrow money. Now, up until about 1917, whenever the government wanted to borrow money, they literally had to pass a law every single time they wanted to borrow money. Each individual act of borrowing required an act of Congress. But it became clear that in 1917, they were going to need to borrow a lot of money in a hurry, and there wasn't going to be time to pass a new law every single time they wanted to do it. So they passed a new kind of legislation, which was called a debt ceiling. And the idea was they would set an overall limit on how much government could borrow, and that overall limit would just be raised if necessary over time. Now, that debt ceiling continues on through the rest of the century. And when you hear arguments about people raising the debt ceiling or the need to raise the debt ceiling, what will happen if they raise the debt ceiling, those are all things that they're generated from this decision in World War I, that that's how the government will regulate what sort of borrowing it does. Now, this made sense at the time. Federal spending increases really dramatically. The total federal budget in 1916 is $700 million. In 1919, the total federal budget is $18 billion. That's a multiple of like 25 in 3 years. It was just desperately important to raise money to fight the war. About 70% of World War I spending was fought on borrowed money. So they were expanding the size of government really by borrowing money the whole way through. Now, of course, the debt ceiling itself has a long and interesting history that follows after this. During the 1920s, we run budget surpluses, so we're reducing our debt, and the debt ceiling isn't very important. During the 1930s and 1940s, the debt ceiling is raised several times. But frankly, when you're in the middle of a Great Depression or while you're in the middle of a world war, you just don't worry very much about things like a debt ceiling. They do raise it a little bit during the 50s and 60s, but there's not a huge amount of government borrowing at that time. And it's not really until the 1980s, when the government budget deficit gets extremely large, that we begin to have to worry about the budget debt ceiling over and over and over. In fact, during the 1980s and 1990s, it's literally been true that Congress has been voting to raise the debt ceiling on average about every 6 months during that time. And to me, the whole thing has become really kind of a silly ritual. Once you've voted for a budget that requires the government to borrow money, you just need to borrow it. I mean, you've committed to spending this money, you've committed to the tax level. But when you've got a debt ceiling, everyone can then argue back and forth over it and try and extract concessions and sort of play chicken and see if one side or another is willing to shut down the government. Now, of course, both sides play this game. When Ronald Reagan was president, the Democrats used the debt ceiling to try and extract concessions in the 1980s. When Bill Clinton is president, the Republicans used the debt ceiling to try and extract concessions during the 1990s. I, for one, am much in favor of reducing the budget deficit, but as the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has written, the debt ceiling is an anachronism. I mean, it was something that was kicked into place during World War I. We should worry about actually reducing the budget deficit, not arguing back and forth over whether and when we're going to raise the ceiling. The war also alters the regulation of labor in a dramatic way. During wartime, it often seems that government is deeply concerned or more worried about the conditions of labor. And in fact, a war labor board is created in 1918 to adjudicate various labor disputes. The government starts encouraging firms to recognize unions during the war because they want to try and make sure that they won't have strikes or other kinds of labor shortfalls. The work week begins to shrink. In fact, it's been shrinking as a gradual process since about 1900. Instead of a 6-day week, we're down to a 5-day week by about 1920. It's more or less a 50-hour week, so 5 days, 10-hour days. In fact, during World War I, the government requires that firms with government contracts establish an 8-hour day and a 44-hour week. So it's like 5.5 days, basically. And these sorts of rules are really tied in to government contracting and to government support for trying to make sure that workers will be satisfied. It's worth noting that these laws about the 8-hour day also come with some trade-offs. For example, what tended to happen before was everyone just kind of showed up at the factory and worked, and then whenever they were done, they kind of left. But when you start saying the day is only 8 hours, they begin to do things like have factories with locked gates where they take attendance and you have to punch in and you punch out. You can't just wander off for lunch in the middle of the day should you feel like it. They also say that if they're only going to have an 8-hour day, they're going to have more discipline in the workforce. And you begin to have laws about things like restricting talking in the workforce and forcing people to pay attention to their jobs in certain ways. The workforce and jobs, remember, had been a much looser kind of thing before this. But the discipline of wartime begins to set up certain rules, which some of which sound good and some of which may not sound so good. The workplace in general is shifting to be a more organized and a more professional environment. We're also beginning to draw African Americans and blacks into the urban labor market. The World War I jobs are encouraging folks to immigrate from the South and up to the North. We're beginning to have race riots occasionally in cities like Chicago and St. Louis because of the feeling that blacks are coming into the city and are taking jobs, and kind of the same, an internal immigration kind of argument. All of this high demand for labor generally meant that wages are going up drastically, faster than the inflation rate. The unemployment rate goes down to almost nothing. Before the war, unemployment was often sort of in the 6-7% range, maybe 8%. By 1918 and 1919, unemployment is 1.4%, so that's darn close to zero. Yet another change that the war brings in terms of thinking about the economy is that for the first time, the government actually nationalizes a lot of companies and a lot of industries and begins to run them in a direct way. There's a Food and Fuel Control Act of 1917, which gives the federal government the power to requisition commodities and take over factories. It gives the power to ensure farmers a certain minimum crop price, and it says that there will be certain meatless days where there won't be meat eaten anywhere because we need that meat for the soldiers and we need the wheat in order for bread and things like that. The government took control of the railroads. And in one of those things that seems a little weird in days where we worry about nepotism and so on, Woodrow Wilson appointed his son to run the railroads through the government. Now, this control of nationalized industries, this government control, was not always a great success. There was actually a fair amount of chaos that resulted. For example, every government agency tried to have its own traffic get the highest priority on the government-run railroads. And the result was just terrible snarls as the government agencies fought back and forth with each other. When the railroads got together and said, we'll try and work all this out by talking to each other, the antitrust authorities sent them letters and said, you're not allowed to work together. So they were sort of under national control, being ordered around by the government and not allowed to talk to each other. Not really a great situation. The federal government also took over the telegraph and the telephone systems. It raised rates by 20% and promptly lost a lot of money anyway because they were run so poorly. The government decided that they needed to build a lot more ships. So they built government shipyards in Wilmington, North Carolina, Newark, New Jersey, Philadelphia, PA. And those shipyards were, of course, to stay around through a lot of this century. But because of bureaucracy and general slowness, no ships were actually launched from any of these shipyards until December 1918, when the war was already basically over. So government control of the economy was not altogether a success. After the war, all these government controls were turned off very fast. Literally half of the war contracts that were outstanding were literally canceled in the month of the war was declared settled. There are stories that business executives who had been working for the government during the war to run their industries, literally when peace was announced, got up, walked out the door of their offices, and never came back. They just left. The price controls were all taken down. Government support for unions was pretty much ended. Both the steel workers and the mine workers try to go on big strikes in 1919, and they're promptly lose, and they're promptly sort of pounded back in their place. We need you during the war. We don't need you so much anymore. And the union movement suffers through the 1920s as a result of this. Now, not all the regulation disappears. For example, railroads stay under the control of the Interstate Commerce Commission, which is still setting the prices, regulating their profits, determining whether they can abandon certain routes and things like that. But the memory of regulation kind of lingered, and the memory is something that's interesting. Lots of business people, remember, kind of like having less competition. And if they can't have private trusts and because of the antitrust laws, they're actually pretty happy to have the government run things. After all, it's kind of nice when the government says, you're so important that we're going to guarantee you a really large profit. A lot of labor unions also kind of liked the war. They liked having the government on their side. They liked having the government really worried about whether they would go out on strike and passing laws about work conditions and hours and things like that. There was also a sense that if these big companies like U.S. Steel and Standard Oil were so efficient, then hey, why shouldn't we have really, really big companies to run everything? And after all, you could just think of the government as being the biggest company of all. Now, as economists argued at the time, and Soviet Russia later demonstrated, size is not always an advantage. Up to a certain point, size may be an advantage, but once you get past that point, then size can actually start turning into a disadvantage. And that's part of what you want the market to do, is to enable enough competition to get up to a certain size, but not beyond that. Also, eliminating competition certainly has costs to consumers and costs to slowing down the growth of the economy. But as always, consumers are not as well represented as big business and big labor are. In general, there's a pattern during the World War I that we'll see in other wartime periods. And it is that you go through fast growth during the war. It's so fast that you begin to get actually a certain amount of inflation. And then after the war, when everything slows down, you fall back into recession. This is the pattern the U.S. economy followed during World War I. There's an argument about exactly how fast the economy grew during the war. It's gone back and forth. But there's no question that there was kind of a hump where the economy grew faster for a few years and then had a recession after the war. The high demand from abroad for all those things that the country was exporting, together with all the war purchases, turn into inflationary pressure. There's too much buying power chasing too few goods. Inflation goes from 1 or 2% a year in the years before about 1915 to 15 to 17% a year from 1917 through 1920. We sometimes think that the end of the century that there, you know, before this, everything was low inflation. That's clearly not true. There were clearly periods of high wartime inflation and periods of new gold discoveries when inflation did get going early in the century. When you think about the economic impact of a war, or any scheme really to give the economy a boost, you really need to think about the whole thing. A lot of people sort of say something like, isn't war attractive? You get this nice boost in the economy. Well, you got to remember that there's a recession that comes after the war and inflation that happens at the same time. And if you're going to think about the whole picture, you have to take all of those things into account. I sometimes think it's kind of like saying you watch an Olympic athlete sprint 400 meters and you say, wouldn't it be great if everyone sprinted everywhere all the time? Well, of course, you can't always sprint everywhere all the time. The economy can't, and that athlete can't either. You can go into overdrive for a little while, but you want to think about all the costs and benefits of the event, not just what it was like at the peak where they were going as fast as possible. In a broad way, you'll see that many of these factors about war and about the impact of World War I happen over time in every war. And by all these factors, I mean, for example, the government raises a lot more money, it raises taxes, it borrows a lot. Income tax tends to expand. Labor gets kid glove treatment during the war and then gets whacked after the war. Business tends to be attracted by high and guaranteed profits in wartime, and the government often organizes things so there's less competition in war. The macroeconomy often has inflation either during the war or you put everything under price controls and things happen later. And after the war, you often get a recession. And that sort of set of patterns we'll be seeing again when we look at World War II. Now, behind the scenes, we've been talking about sort of government things that happen. I also want to spend a little time on things that happen behind the scenes during this decade, which are perhaps not as prominent as the war, but in their own way are just as important. And the first one to discuss is Taylorization, as I like to call it. Frederick Taylor, after whom Taylorization is named, is not a relative of mine or anything like that, but in a way, I wouldn't really mind if he was. Taylor was born in 1856 to a wealthy Philadelphia family. His family took him to Europe. He knew Latin, geometry, different things like that. And at 18, he became an apprentice to a pump manufacturing firm, which was not at all uncommon at the time. It was common for wealthy young men who were going to run businesses to start off as apprentices for a year or two before they got going. He later went to work at a steel mill, and he became famous at that steel mill and later on for developing what were called time and motion studies, or as he put it, a theory of scientific management for how people could do things more and more efficiently. Now, Taylor's name is not as prominent today as it once was, but he was globally prominent at the time, and not just in capitalist countries. Lenin read one of Taylor's early books, and in speeches used to argue that this approach should be adopted in the new Soviet state. In Weimar Germany in the 20s, people talked about Taylorismus and wrote books about it. In France, people talked about Taylorism and wrote books about it. 12 years after Taylor died, there's a story that his widow went to an industrial congress that happened to be in Italy, and Mussolini sought out the widow and swapped an autographed picture of himself for a picture of Frederick Taylor. What's all this about? What's Taylorismus about? The prevailing theory before Taylor, drawing heavily on sort of labor-oriented arguments from Karl Marx, really saw the world of work as a zero-sum game. You had to compete against each other and fight with each other. Employers and their employees were battling, and it was just a question of who would win. Taylor's notion of scientific management was that the world should be thought of as a positive sum game, and that both sides could benefit if we just carried out management in a sensible, scientific kind of way. To give you a feeling for what he sounded like, let me quote briefly from the beginning of his Principles of Scientific Management, which was published in 1914. He said, "The principal object of management should be to secure the maximum prosperity for the employer coupled with the maximum prosperity for each employee. The words maximum prosperity are used in their broad sense to mean not only large dividends for the company or owner, but the development of every branch of the business to its highest state of excellence. In the same way, maximum prosperity for each employee means not only higher wages than are usually received by men of his class, but of more importance still, it means the development of each man to his state of maximum efficiency, so that he may be able to do, generally speaking, the highest grade of work for which his natural abilities fit him." Taylor went around with stopwatches, timing people on things like shoveling coal or carrying pieces of iron or doing all the things they did during the day. He studied how much they should do things, how big the shovel should be, how much should be lifted. Should you lift from the top of the pile or the middle of the pile or the bottom of the pile? Which sort of men were the best men to be doing shoveling? What was the right build for those men? Should they have different shovels if they're shoveling different things, heavier things or lighter things? And so in all those ways, he discovered that it was often possible to double and triple and even quadruple output. And as a result, the workers could get far higher wages and the employer could also get far higher profits. Now, of course, in modern terms, we tend to think of the darker side of Taylor's philosophy. We tend to think of the guy with a stopwatch standing behind you saying, you know, do this, do this, do this, do this. And we tend to think of that as a certain kind of control that seems uncomfortable to us today. And there are a couple of responses to this sort of concern. One is kind of a cheap answer, but a real one. You know, if Lenin didn't think it was exploiting the workers, you would think that Lenin was kind of an expert on that sort of subject. And if he was comfortable with that treatment of workers, it's hard to have a good Marxist objection to it. The better answer, I think, is more an economic principle. It is that in the end, workers get what they get paid is determined by what they produce. I mean, it has to be that way over the broad scheme of things. If you increase production, you are able to make wages higher. If you don't increase production, you're not going to be able to pay higher wages in the long term. What people get is sort of determined by what's produced. Taylor put this, I think, very nicely in a gentle kind of way. He said, a great deal has been and is being constantly said about sweatshop work and conditions. The writer has great sympathy with those who are overworked, but on the whole, a greater sympathy for those who are underpaid. For every individual, however, who is overworked, there are hundreds who intentionally underwork every day of their lives, and for this reason, deliberately aid in establishing those conditions, which in the end inevitably result in low wages. And yet hardly a single voice is being raised in an endeavor to correct this evil. I mean, if you worry about people being overworked, that's legitimate fear. But if by working differently and working with the stopwatches, you can triple your output, and do that much better, well, that's something to be cheered. It's something to be cheerful about. And broadly, this idea that you could organize things efficiently and run things efficiently through scientific management was a lot of the principle by which the government tried to organize industries during World War I and the way large companies tried to organize all of their employees during that same time. At the same time, there are also many gentle changes happening in the standard of living. In 1900, you may remember, only 3% of homes were lit by electricity, 88% by coal, oil, and kerosene, and a few by gas. By 1910, we're up to 15% of the homes lit by electricity. And we're beginning to get more and more of an expansion of these things and of electricity as we go on. Autos and radios and things like that are becoming more widespread. The automobile revolution and the idea that you can have electricity in your home and plug in things like the radio are beginning to spread. And so, although the major changes in America's standard of living are waiting for the 1920s, you can begin to see these patterns evolving of new products, new scientific management, larger factories that are better run, certain kinds of organization of labor that weren't there before as much. When many people talk about the birth of big government at the end of the century, they tend to look back to the 1960s, and they sort of say, you know, that was when we had the Great Society, that was when big government was born. People with slightly longer memories look back to the 1930s and Franklin Roosevelt's No Deal, and they sort of say, oh, that was really when big government was born. I think that both those sets of people have memories that are a little bit too short. I think if you look back and say, when was big government really born in the United States? It was this decade, from 1910 to 1920. That's when government really established that it could run things, that it could borrow lots and lots of money, that it could collect lots of money through the income tax, and that it would set up things to control banks and control competition. I think that decade is really the decade where we begin to think differently about the relationship between government and how it is going to interact with a modern industrial economy.